your studies, and you may be showing them, but I think we can't depend on that anymore. We can on oil prices or continuing the same rate of volume oil. It's another heavy factor that's likely to come into play. But they say 17% reduction for education nationally this year from federal government, information.
I understand what you're saying, but it seems to me that we may have missed our bet. In fact, I keep thinking back to the time when Greg was even working on that probably, when Governor Sheffield presented the budget reserve constitutional amendment concept, which we all kind of didn't understand quick enough, I think. That's the time we should have done something like this. It really said you could increase spending by a certain amount, decrease, you could fall by a certain amount, and everything else was set aside, and you dipped into that fund only to maintain stability. We should have done that in 1984, whatever year it was that was being suggested, I think. I guess I'm not sure how you do that now when you're facing a drastic reduction. I mean, how do you stop a drastic decline in the economy and in the meantime putting in a budget stabilization plan at the same time?
Well, let's go ahead and run some of these. I mean, it obviously is an issue that has to have sort of all kinds of political judgments and analysis made. But essentially what we're basically suggesting is that the only way you can get there in terms of the discipline is if, in fact, there's something like a master agreement among the lawmakers over what is our strategy and there are no exceptions. Everything works within essentially a targeted revenue cap and an expenditure cap and the designated reserves. Whether or not that kind of commitment can be forthcoming, given the uncertainties that we're talking about and the pain that's implicit with these budget cuts that we're talking about, I mean, these are very real jobs. I mean, they're friends, neighbors, associates, and unfortunately, under the trend of revenues, it's an unrelenting process. That is, not only do you make a reduction this year, but you make another reduction next year, and the year after that, and the year after that. So but what we're trying to suggest is that it's actually healthier for the economy and for the state services to actually anticipate what's likely to come rather than appearing as though we're going to hit the wall in 96 and no one has anticipated essentially what we're going to do, but everyone's conjuring up their own theories. And our concern is, we've oftentimes been criticized for being somewhat myopic in our concentration on fiscal policy, but our feeling is that any kind of major long-term investment in the state, unless it's unique to a particular resource commodity, is not going to make a significant investment in Alaska as long as this fiscal uncertainty continues to loom. Because it has this dynamite fuse on it when we hit the wall in 96. And somehow the most constructive thing we can do to long-term capital investments in the state is to have our public sector as much in order in terms of a stable presence as we can possibly imagine it. That includes monitoring the federal government expenditures as well, because obviously looking at our relative shares of employment, the federal government continues to represent essentially a very substantial chunk, almost 25% of the total. But anyway, that was our sense. But why don't we go ahead and just run through a few of these other illustrations and.
The other element of uncertainty with regard to the level of ultimate revenues from existing sources from petroleum, in addition to price, of course, is production levels. And the conventional thinking now is that production levels will continue to decline out of the crude oil curve. Although, as Lee mentioned, we have seen in the last 2 years an upward revision of the official state forecast of production levels through the early to mid-1990s of in the neighborhood of 150,000 barrels a day. Certainly good news, but as Lee also mentioned, we're not entirely sure how much of that is additional production versus how much of it we're just borrowing from future production.
Well, what about such things as WEFSAC and so on? Oil hits a certain price, there's immense production potential. Is there any factor in?
I think that some WEFSAC production is factored into the Department of Revenue high case, at least. I'm not sure if it's in the
media. I guess post-Caporic, just a kind of slip. I'll get off to it then.
Mr. Chairman, I think that would be a useful piece of information, though, because there's always that issue raised. And
well, that is one obvious source at some level. What they say, the $25, $26 level, and there's a greater potential, or the equal potential to crude oil, if you get a recovery up there at 30%.
I just related conversations with both Bill Hartz and Darley. Their response to me was, don't we wish? They didn't see oil prices getting anywhere near the threshold price required to bring those fields into development. When I brought it up as an issue, they kind of scowled and scoffed that if anybody was interested in that, they were, and they didn't see it happening.
You know, 10 years ago, they scowled and scoffed at going west, too, into Anwar. I mean, they said there was nothing there. They knew there may be, but they just scowled and scoffed at it.
But, Mr. Chairman, they've always said, it seems to me, on WestSAC, that you were looking at a price somewhere in the neighborhood of 25, 26,
that's true. That's true.
27 barrels. They've always said that, and that's not with an inflation factor. So, you know, there's, maybe it's there, maybe it's not.
The other obvious thing.
So if you have an infrastructure of empty pipeline and so on in place, there's other things tightened up, maybe less percentage for the state. All those combinations may seek to reduce.
The other important consideration, distinction between a Prudhoe Bay and a WestSAC is the capital investment required per barrel of oil produced. A typical well in the Prudhoe Bay field produces, even today, about 2,500 barrels on a daily basis. And they're looking at production rates 100 barrels per day from a well out of a marginal field like WestSAC. So the capital investment per barrel produced is much higher. Profit margin is much lower.
Still in the Southwest, you produce very low volume. Watch the infrastructure supply. You keep growing, you produce pretty low volume growing wells. The infrastructure is getting close to being in place. Or you can walk away from there, you might, I don't know.
Well, technology is not standing constant either. So, I mean, we've seen some very substantial increased efficiencies in drilling costs and so forth that also have a positive effect on those costs and therefore the productivity of the field, the marginal threshold of these fields. But again, I mean, I think those are things that each year as we look out, we can revise those with better information on the next year. So this year we may have nothing in there. Next year we're going to have more information. We can update that and come up with a better forecast as we get closer out to the actual reality of what prices are looking like.
Well, if you're talking to a 10-year forecast, I think you have to figure that in.
What are you looking at? What do you think? 5 in year?
What's that?
52. But, you know, what is a horizon that we ought to be working with? Let's assume we do a budget stabilization strategy. We sell it. Do we try to do it for 10 years? Do we try to do it for 5 years? Revise it annually.
Well, my own feeling is that we ought to at least try to get beyond the decade.
Yeah.
You go much beyond that, and it becomes smoke and mirrors. I mean, I don't. We know that we still have a continuing problem with the exhaustion of Prudhoe Bay. But again, historically, there's been a lot more recovery out of these original estimates and reserves than we anticipated. I think the numbers start to fall apart as you get out to the year 2005, and there's just too much uncertainty. But if we could go to the year 2000, I think we would at least have advanced significantly where we are.
Well, I was scared you were going to have a 5-year plan, but our neighbors probably.
They're no longer in fashion.
2000,
but with any plan, it would need to be incremental in the sense that every year you have an additional year's worth of information about what's going on. I think that this diagram, which shows Alaska oil production historically, is a useful example to illustrate that.
Would you explain this diagram to me?
Yes. This represents actual Alaskan oil production in million barrels per year, and just divided production into that coming off of Prudhoe which is the big curve here on the right. The mother of all oil fields. And all other. Just to give a slightly different perspective than one normally sees on where the oil is coming from and what's happening to oil production in the two contrasting areas. And I guess the main points of this are, first of all, that if you look at the Prudhoe field, it plateaued for about 10 years. And while it was plateauing, we were having growth in our other fields. Other fields were coming along, Kuparuk and Lisbourne and so on and so forth. And so total production was growing because of that. Prudhoe production peaked in 87. And now, the last year, 91, we just got the figures, it's down 18% from the peak. It's only about 82% of what it was at its peak. During the same last 3 or 4 year period, there really hasn't been any growth from the other fields. And so we're looking at statewide production declining from a peak in 1988. And of course the question is, what's going to happen in the next years? And really the only way to know is to go on a year-by-year basis. But clearly you want to use the information that you have from historical production records to drive your whatever strategy you have for trying to meet a goal by the year 2000 of having a stabilization policy in place.
And the industry, for example, used to say that they expected the rate of decline to be somewhere between 6 to 9%. This 18% decline from the peak production would be a little over 6, not quite 7%, 6% a year. And if that's the rate the first 3 years, it might accelerate a little bit, but that was the rate that the industry has been using in their own representations of the rates of decline of crude oil. Mr. Chairman, would you like us to review some of these other exhibits? I know the hour is going on. We'd be happy to walk through.
Why don't you walk through some? And the senators will come and go. They have draws, but if you've got the time. Anything that you think might be of value to us, very particular thing.
What we'd like to do now is show you in building block format how one possible version of a budget stabilization strategy would fit together, how the various elements might look in terms of filling in a fiscal gap. Okay. So let me walk through these fairly quickly. As Lee mentioned, there's five components that we've identified. And what I'm going to do is just overlay each component in turn on this original diagram that showed growing state expenditures in contrast to the existing revenues, and see how far we can get in building up something that, as you get out towards the year 2000, begins to look like something that's sustainable, something that we can continue. And the elements are not in any kind of order of preference or anything. They're just the way that the analysis fell out. Okay, the first element would be something like a personal income tax. Okay. As Lee mentioned, if we taxed ourselves households and businesses at national average rates, we might get $500 million. I think I've thrown in here about $350 million. Keep it below national average rates to see what we can get. And obviously that, towards the end, Arliss. Right. Obviously, if you overlaid this kind of a tax, you'd be getting this every year. Okay. So that's why it just jacks up the whole revenue picture.
So the bottom dark line is existing forecast off petroleum revenues. The second dark line is laying on about $350 million worth of income taxes on top of it.
We still have a widening gap as we go out in time. So the question is, what can you do to sort of fill in a big wedge? And there the obvious solution is we use the permanent fund somehow. Use the savings from the permanent fund. But you don't want to bring it on all at once because you're going to need more of it as time goes by. But if you had some sort of a plan that shifted the earnings of the permanent fund from its current purpose to filling in part of the fiscal gap, then you could get this wedge shape, which would fit nicely into fill the large part of the gap.
So this graph here suggests that not until the year 2000 do you start using permanent earnings to...
Under this particular scenario.
You could run any.
It could do any, but I mean, this graph
yeah. This graph shows you start in 2000.
Yeah, you start to use the earnings in the year 2000 to help to fund government. And you don't use the corpus at all.
Right. Mr. Chairman, what's happened in all this time with this? It's not reflected, is it the pools of money? Or are you using those pools of money in your existing revenues?
We haven't come to the use of the pools.
That's coming.
But their interest and all that jazz is kind of outside.
So far, it's coming in next.
Yeah.
It'll be number four.
I won't anticipate.
In order, there are a number of ways you could restructure the use of the earnings to generate that wedge. One would be something that looks like this, ramping down the dividend, putting the earnings back into the corpus for a period of time, and then starting to draw them out.
Would you explain this?
This is just one way to shift the use of the earnings of the fund. Okay, this represents the entire earnings of the fund, the permanent fund, after inflation proof.
Okay.
This is the real earnings of the permanent fund, which today are running about $500 million. In other words, that's what you can draw each year in earnings without reducing the value of the corpus.
Now, wait a minute. You're talking then after inflation proofing, aren't you? Yeah,
I'm turning it around. I'm saying the inflation proof first by some...
Sure,
some,
and then your earnings left over.
Whatever we got left over.
Yeah, that's right.
So by the year 2010, if we had a zero dividend, continued inflation proof had zero dividend, the earnings off the fund would take to the general fund, according to this graph, about $700 million.
Right.
Can we inflation proof, no dividend?
No dividend. The earnings then that could be used for general fund purposes would be about $700 million in the year 2010.
This assumes a 4% return on that.
Which historically, what have we done now?
Historically, it's done better. But
they're still looking though in their fingers at 3% and plus interest, I think. But in fact, it's been higher.
It has been. Yeah. So another way of saying it is, in 2010, $700 million could be pulled off the permanent fund.
The broad enough fund, important enough fund now that will follow the inflationary trends. If say everything went to hell in the American economy and fund became worth much, much less, but the real dollars then would still be holding it about the same what they were buying. their income reduced to $100 million in the permanent fund, that $100 million in the basic credit investment could still buy about like $700 a year.
You know, it would be an interesting chart to have, and I think you could probably do it. And based on, this is zeroing out the dividend, which, you know, it's going to be a tough political call, right? But even capping it at $500 million is going to Senator Sturzewski legislation suggested. Yeah. How, if you cap at $500 million, you did inflation proofing, then how much would be thrown off as available?
Yeah, we've got the chart.
You have that chart?
Yeah, we've run a lot of numbers.
I'm hopeful that as that bill moves, the Senator Sturzewski will also file for office because I'm on the ball. I think it should be the same time.
But I mean, it's a whole lot less, right? I mean, if you need the dividend there, I mean, you're at $500 million.
As it is here, the dividend is just being reduced 10% a year.
Yeah. You know,
so it takes 10 years to get rid of the dividend.
So is it safe to say just ballparking, if you need a dividend of $500 million, that all you've got for the general fund is about $200 million for the year 2010?
Oh, no, it'd probably be, well, yeah, if you kept cap on the dividend forever, yeah, you wouldn't have very much left over.
And it takes it to kick in, because, see, at the current rate, we're not fully inflation-proofing. So you would fully inflation-proof, and that would draw down some of that. So it takes it 4 or 5 years for it. It's got a positive, before there's any positive dollars, if you do it at 500.
Now, one reason we won't talk about today, but it would be an element in any kind of budget stabilization act, is trying to maximize the revenue enhancements so that, I think it will be time for us to look at, for example, much more active participation in equities on the part of the permanent fund. It will be time to talk about getting a lot more leverage out of the placement of those investments that we make. So I think there are a number of other dimensions that are associated with the permanent fund and its, quote, contribution to the economy that will become increasingly significant to all Alaskans and not simply the dividend stream itself. But that's an issue I'd rather not get into this morning. Should we go to the part three?
Yeah. The third element of a strategy would be some kind of a cap on the budget. And that would include the entire budget. And as it's characterized here, the cap is basically related to the growth in the rate of inflation. And there is growth built into this particular cap, but at a rate that is less than the rate of inflation, but over time eases. Okay, so that in the first couple of years, the cap is a cap in nominal dollars, but gradually the nominal dollar cap expands.
So your budget stabilization and your cap come together to yield you the same income and the same expenditure in 2009.
Right.
Yeah. The idea is to try to hit with that budget cap what your revenues are going to be.
Are these always $92?
They're always $92. And you can see that there's no way that you can characterize a real simple rule, a formula that will assure you of being able to do that. So there's one additional element that has to be built in.
Guys, as you move this, the other thing I wanted to observe was that we're using a tax rate that brought in about $350 million. We had estimated that if we taxed both state and local government tax at the rate at which the average of the national rates of taxation, local governments could raise another $150 million, I believe it was. And so when you're backing out of this state spending, the assumption is that the burden goes on to the local taxpayer, so that the total tax burden is essentially $500 million, but only $350 million supports state spending. The other part is pushed down into local government spending. Mm-hmm.
Just an aside, what's the impact of that kind of a budget cap on per capita spending. And it would look something like this. And this characterization also shows the gradual elimination of the dividend under that redirection of the earnings policy. The final element that I wanted to show is what we call, for lack of a better term yet, a transitional fund, which is what's necessary to fill any remaining gap after you have put in place these other three elements of a strategy. And this transitional fund would come out of, the funding of this transitional fund would be the combination of the remaining non-permanent fund assets of the state today, that $2 billion, plus windfalls.
Where do they represent that? I'm sorry. Oh, they'd be the
Here. It's that land. And the purpose of the transitional fund, as opposed to the purpose of stabilization associated with fluctuating price, is to fill in the last bit of this gap anticipated out in the latter part of the decade and early in the next decade. And this is the part of the strategy that's the most difficult. None of it's easy, but this is the most difficult to implement. But this is the part that would involve the discretion on the part of policymakers, because this is where you would this is where you have the fudge factor.
This is where not only you raise taxes, eliminate the dividend, cut services, but also hold cash reserves back. So.
And that holding the cash reserves is the most difficult, I kind of think.
Yeah.
In this day, but raising taxes and eliminating dividend may be just slightly difficult.
People running government come from varying walks of life and add their little bit to what's going on. So now the two of you should be running for office.
Okay.
Message. And to initiate and implement it both.
And this is all based on the income tax going in this year, it looks like.
Well, this year, next year, I mean, the sooner we get on with this, the...
everything.
Yeah.
But what about the Reaganomics, as I heard originally up here, or Bush had an economics or something, who said that as soon as we take from the private sector a certain income, you still affect jobs in the same way as though you took it from the state. It's all part of that pool of dollars into the state to do certain things.
This is easy.
So, and jobs being a major factor, again, of our well-being, other things happening. So that's a big question of pulling taxes out if you're still reducing the job factor. I don't know. How do you come to that answer? How do you come to something positive out of that question?
Well, it's tough to be positive, but if you're looking at trying to minimize the job loss in the Alaska economy, that's where you can go back to the first chart looking at the relative impact of $100,000 budget cuts.
Yeah.
And raising personal income taxes has the least negative impact for
$100,000
of income taxes of all other forms of reductions, whether it's in the state spending per capita.
1,100 jobs down if you...
Lee, can we look at 1994 on this last graph? Let me just ask a question. That just brought a question to my mind here. Looking at 1994, looking at the spending cap, which is the line with the X through it, right? 1994 comes out to about $2.7 billion or whatever. That's about a $200 million reduction from the desired level of about? It is, close to it. That's going to translate to a loss of like 2,400 jobs. From the economy down to it.
We're going to cross the board cut.
With the cross board cut. And you're increasing the income tax, you're going to raise about how much?
Well, in 94 out of that, $350 million.
So do you add, then that, every time you raise $100 million there, you eliminate?
3,000 additional. So there's another 3,000 jobs.
So the impact of this plan from where we're at now could be 5,500 jobs,
right,
lost.
How do you like him?
Depends where they are.
Pardon?
How do you like it? Depends on where they are.
Yeah, but I mean, it's spread between public and private sector, especially when you put the income tax on, then that's the private sector jobs primarily, and the public sector is about 50-50, so it's probably more than 50-50 private sector to do that combination.
If you have an employment base of 250,000 workers, you know, normally a 1% growth in the overall employment level would be about 2,500. So a loss through these reductions would counter offset, say, a 2% growth. But if the overall economy is flat, then this would be a 2% loss.
Mr. Chairman?
So, but that continues. That continues. So you got 5,500 jobs lost in 1994. I'm just trying to ballpark this. And that continues each year as you slowly put that lid on the budget and as you continue to collect taxes and as you use the permanent fund earnings, do away with the dividend. So you don't have just one hit at the economy, you have a sustained reduction.
Jay, wait a second.
Oh. That's why it's so nice. Every year.
Yeah. Every year somebody loses their job, right?
Mr. Chair, I know this meeting's going to have to come to an end, but if, you know, I hope we can pursue with him what a budget stabilization strategy means, because there's a lot of stuff we're not doing. We're not looking at the income potential. How do we manage 104 million acres of land? A whole lot of things we're not focusing on because we're all focusing on, you know, just this immediate impact. And somehow, if we get a process that says we're going to have discipline in this area and these are the things, we'll have something to take to the public. And rather than to wait to 96, I hope we can pursue what could we do so that then we can start to get some debate about what are those additional things we can do. Because here we're dealing with known factors, and we really haven't looked at some of the other opportunities in any kind of a rational way. But
I subscribe to what you're saying.
Yeah.
It was triggering in my mind, what are the alternatives,
sure,
what are the opportunities out there that don't get factored in, so you're right.
Well, yeah, but we'll never do those until it's desperate, and a lot of the things, I mean, I see us, and where I'm very concerned, as you well know, is to see things like science and tech. I know of some things that are happening out there, and everything will be drained away, and we'll not have those opportunities if we don't start to look at those in terms of what we have here. So I'm really appreciative of this, but I think this is just the first step, because we've cried wolf, and we're, you know, in a sense that's all we do if we stop here. So I just
sort of conclude our presentation. I personally think it would be useful to actually have a blue ribbon commission that would consist not only of the governor and the speaker of the House and the president of the Senate, but the president of the university, someone from local government, president of the Chamber of Commerce, the Chief Justice, to get some of these major interested parties to sit down and look at this and find out what is the problem, rather than simply coming to the legislature constantly beating the legislature over the head over a problem that can't be solved by simply continuing to spend more. And Senator Pershore asked if we were about to produce our last sort of fiscal policy paper in terms of offering more sort of gratuitous suggestions on strategies, particularly as it relates to state spending. And I would just sort of share four or five major types of categories we were going to suggest. One is to move as quickly as possible to a needs-based formula for allocating the transfer payments and other sources of state support. A second is to increase the required local effort and provide.
That will hire a lot more people, I think.
The second is to actually move towards an increase in the required local effort and to ensure that that has an equalization component to it. The third that I know everyone's already discussing is looking carefully at the increased use of user fees. And the fourth, I think, is one where the state simply has to come up with a strategy on containing these categorical and entitlement programs. Looking at the increases in the Medicare claims and the AFDC are growing at a rate of 33% over the last, just the last three fiscal years. And obviously, at that rate of growth, if you're talking about capping spending, we're talking about massive kind of harm and hardship that's associated with those types of programs. And yet we continue to see claims, for example, of a new hospital construction when the current facility might be used at a very minimal rate. There has to be a way in which the local community actually is asked to put up a significant portion of that share. And I personally think that moving away from the 100% capital is, in fact, a move in the right direction, so that some of the burden, even though it's equalized on the basis of your ability to contribute, still has to represent some commitment on the part of the local communities that they're willing to pay, and that would include the unorganized borough.
Was that four things or five things?
I got four.
That's sort of a fifth of the large local match.
Oh.
More local effort.
Well, he was saying...
That was an extension of the required local effort and the...
It goes back to number two.
Use-based, increased local effort, increased user fees, the federal programs, and what was the fifth one?
More local
effort. There wasn't.
We explained local effort.
I went back to the number two.
Okay, you're just doubly sure about that.
Well, you were pretty well.
You didn't want to miss one, right?
Yeah, I think that's very useful. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Very much.
Thank
you. Good. Tell us what we got to do, and
we'll just do it. By the way,
yeah. When do you get those bills introduced?
I'm willing to work with you. I'll introduce them, but I can't.
What district do you live in?
No, our list of my lines is constantly changing when you're introduced. It's yours, Commissioner. You may have the floor. We are recorded, and. You and your staff wish to identify themselves once when they first speak. That's great.
Okay. Do we need to turn on the teleconference ones?
No, I don't think we're teleconferencing today. We're not trying to nail you before the world unless you have your followers and press up here, which may well be.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Harold Hines. I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources. I have with me Sharon Barton, who under our new organization is Deputy Commissioner and Chief of our Support Staff. I'm here this morning, and Senator, I presume on the timeline we've got something a little less than an hour to review with you our recommendations as to reductions from the FY93 Governor's budget submitted.
Commissioner, if it takes more time, we'll take it and apologize to the next committee and the next group. And, you know,
I was trying to indicate I'm prepared to try and help in the time management in
sure.
any way I can. The other night, Monday night, we had the opportunity to appear before the House Finance Committee. Number one, I guess I wanted to express my appreciation for starting at 9 a.m. as opposed to 9 p.m. like I had to the other night. This is much more civilized, and I do appreciate it.
We think so, too.
Secondly, in preparing for that hearing the other night, on Monday night, did manage to eat Chinese. And there was two fortune cookies that came with dinner, the first of which read, consolidate rather than expand business projects in the near future. And I thought that was a little prophetic. And the other was, the only way to have a friend is to be one. So I've come to you in a very friendly mode this morning. I've got some ideas as to how we do these reductions. I am certainly open to talking about them. By way of just...
I always worried about you when you and I served together on a previous board when you came in a friendly mode. I knew you were up to something.
Just by way of, again, general introduction to the department... In preparing these reduction proposals, within the department, we've actually, for several months, been cycling through a series of exercises that were probably less number-oriented and more conceptual-oriented as to what we would do in the case of significant budget reduction. Out of that exercise, there was two basic ideas that emerged that we've tried to honor in these. One was that while DNR is a major contributor to the state and its people in the form of production. As an agency, we also are a consumer. We do spend things that do not produce. As a matter of fact, probably over half of our department's activity are more towards consumption than production. So one of the ideas that we hit upon was in any reduction, we felt it was important that we kept an eye on that balance, and if anything, try to shift it more towards production than consumption. Secondly, we realized in a difficult budget world, the word I used was a draconian world at the extreme, our benefit to people, our relevance to our citizens, was the key in really deciding what programs were the most important. And in our department, of course, we directly affect the economy, we directly affect jobs that exist and are created.
Thank you.
We provide all different types of services to the public, from recording to personal use, and so on. We basically are the revenue generator at a fundamental level in this resource state and in this owner state. But the one thing, again, I'd just like to remind folks is that as a royalty owner and a bonus owner, we contribute to the state's revenue picture, but the other flip side of that, over half those revenues go to the permanent fund, and we are the only depositor in the permanent fund. And that makes our people relevance of a lot of our programs very high, in my opinion. What we've got,
as you probably know, we feel we deposit 50% permanent fund through a legislative mechanism, even though you brought in the money.
Well, again, that's why I said more than half to the permanent fund. We appreciate that.
No, we deposited, right? The income is 51.2% from the legislative deposit.
From what area of the state?
53%.
What area?
From what permanent area? Fund from the legislative.
From rural Alaska.
From rural Alaska.
No, from part of Al Adams' district. Thank you very much. Excuse me.
We both have the pleasure of contributing to the permanent fund from the revenues generated from royalties and bonuses. In terms of the programmatic cuts here, there are some management options here that we've laid out. There are some revenue increases that we're looking at in terms of fees and program receipts. There are reductions in both program and people, and there are significant reductions in the grants and pass-throughs that are included in our budget. I don't know what the easiest senator to work from. We have distributed to you a three-page little handout sheet.
If you want to just run briefly the reasons for the reductions and justifications quickly, I think that's probably what we want to do now. Again, the vision that my constituency has is that we're not cutting operating general government enough, and we're always cutting the pass-throughs too much. So any place that you're cutting general operating government, at least bring it to our attention. I'm sure other areas and other districts may have different visions of the budget, but we'd like to know where you had to cut off a finger or a leg or an arm.
Yeah. Senator, the other night I sort of went through it all, and then we came back for questions, and frankly, it was kind of dull. I'd be happy to just sort of,
okay.
If you have questions on each item, let's just sort of take them off, and again, I'll try to help with the time management in terms of my answer length. But,
thank you.
If that's all right with you.
It is. It's a good program.
Okay.
Senator Hoffman does have a question.
Well, if he was going to go down, then
I would just like to sort of step through them, and then I guess all I'm suggesting is why don't we take questions as we go through each of the divisions, basically.
Senator Adams.
Well, the first question is from the positions from FY92 at 479 full-time and 9 part-time. With this particular draft that we have in front of us, how many positions have you eliminated for this coming year? And then the statutory changes, have you drafted that particular language so it will be prepared to go along with your recommended changes at this particular time?
As regards to personnel levels, the FY93 governor's submittal to you was basically level. I think there was a change of one in permanent full-time envisioned in that budget. We saw that as a status quo staffing type budget. We have not done any detailed estimate of the people reductions associated with this, but we did go through and identify the people type dollars, and just using some rules of thumb, we would estimate that it's about 24 people, around two dozen, give or take some, that we're talking about in terms of the reductions. I forgot.
And then the draft language to go with the changes that you need to draft language to make these changes. Is somebody preparing that language to go along with your recommended changes?
I would prefer to do that as we go through it. We've kind of indicated it on these sheets.
That's fine.
And I will highlight for you any of those as we go through it.
Senator Adams cut right through to the core of the questions. Yeah. Thank you.
And again, it's a very important. There are a number of significant changes here that without legislative change do not happen. Starting first with the water, and in this area, we are presuming in this gives the department and the division of water the authority to levy fees for large users of water. And that is very key. If you make the opposite assumption, then this structure here is all wrong.
I think I do have a question to that, and I jump over. To the extent that you now have expenditures within the budget to support personnel and office space, et cetera, for these services, and they're being transferred or have been transferred to one component, now water or whatever, will the fees pick up any extra costs then that that you have for this department beyond what you would have had previously in the varying components of your budget? In other words, is the $350,000 or whatever it is that you expect in fees picking up any added costs that you've incurred to your division for this?
Senator, the way we've looked at the fee structure, obviously, again, with the passage of the bill, we would go through a regulatory process. So I can't say with certainty what the fee level would be. The way we have looked at it is that we believe the in-state level of fee structure from large users should approach the level of covering the water division. It will not pay for all the programs within the water division. If there are water exports, the fees from that should be more than sufficient to actually throw off general fund money that would be available for other water-related projects or other uses by the legislature. And that's the basic way we've kind of looked at the design here.
I'm going to get into something that wouldn't please you, and it may be political, and it means not to make a comment, but to some extent, why shouldn't I assume that this whole agency wasn't put together just to take care of one particular person's need for a job?
Senator, I am the person responsible for the creation of a water division. And I certainly know why I did it. I've said it a number of times that in looking over what was going on in the Division of Land and Water, what I found was that what I considered to be very important water issues, the issues of ownership, of navigability, of measurement, knowing even what we had, even having a list of what the rivers were in Alaska, which did not exist, I felt that water was constantly coming out fourth, fifth, and sixth on the list in terms of priorities. As such, you tend in agencies to really only get done one, two, and three. And the problem was we weren't getting anywhere. So it was my decision that to get management attention on the water issues, we would spring off the department. I think we've accomplished a lot of that. We've made our navigability filing, first major assertion of the navigability process following up on the court cases with the BLM. We have generated a list right now of 18,000 rivers in Alaska, and it's still going, and so on. We have looked at a session we call the Water Summit, where we got together all the agencies in the state that deal with water in some respect to try and understand where duplication was, where focus ought to be, for instance, on databases and things like that. I think the payoff has been very high. I am concerned by the resistance that I have seen to the water fee structure. I just have to tell you that when it's all over and said and done, if we don't have the authority to charge for large uses of water, then I am going to take that as policy direction. And I think we have no choice but to realize that as a matter of policy, we do not consider water to be a valued resource. And if that's the case, then I think we have to reassess certainly what I've done. I feel very strongly that water is a valuable resource. I think we need to manage it that way. But we're never going to get it through people's head that it's valuable if it is free to everybody for every use, including export.
Well, I won't continue on. And I suspect that your goal is laudatory and necessary. Let it go at that. They proceed.
Well, again, the water issue here is really one of revenue, and that is the approach that's shown there entirely is a revenue increase type approach incrementally.
This new rent revenue is generated by the passage of the piece of legislation that you have listed here. What if you don't see the passage of the, where will you take this reduction of $1.4 million?
We will take it in the form of the water division.
Okay. Thank you.
Without the revenues to support it, it as a policy call, I think is a no-brainer what you do in a budget sense.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Fire suppression. The elements shown here of $1 million reduction obviously is laden with the problem of never knowing how much we're going to spend any year on fire suppression. What we've tried to indicate here is that there are a number of management opportunities here which we think can save these kind of dollars. While we will put and maintain our priority of saving human life, protecting human health, and protecting our communities, we can be much more conservative in the other fires we fight. We would not protect remote structures under this type of an approach. We would not commit large resources to fires that were out in the midst of nowhere. Secondly, there is opportunity to look at both our own management of this program. There are a number of good ideas that could improve it. Our basic problem here is working one with the federal government, who actually is the larger payer for fire suppression in Alaska. Our only hope is that their budget pressures would also force them to look at the same kinds of things we have. And they may need to deviate from some of their policies that they would use in the lower 48 here in Alaska.
Many people concerned about the grazing opportunities for moose and wildlife and so on feel that a lot of areas ought to be left burned, particularly Jack Spruce areas and so on. You know, Representative Harris from down on the Kuskokwim, former DOT commissioner, always said that we missed the boat in many of those areas that we were controlling. Timber is one thing. Brush was another, and that we ought to be letting it, managing like you're suggesting, presumably.
Certainly from the wildlife side, there are strong arguments for less fire suppression. On the other hand, I don't want to indicate to you that we just walk away from these responsibilities. One of the things we found is sometimes we can intervene in a fire very early and quickly, and in a very measured sort of way, and get it under control. What I'm suggesting here is that these fires that are in the hinterlands of Alaska, where it would take a huge commitment of effort to bring them under control, that we just not make consciously that decision. Right now, I believe for the last few years, our fire managers have stressed the fire suppression program to the point that we need to say to them, look, from day one of the fiscal year, there is a cost problem here, and we want you to deal with it that way. again, that is one that, as we would work through any subcommittee process, Senator, be happy to discuss that in more detail.
Our experiences in reductions at this level have never been transmitted into reductions administratively. We just always end up with supplemental to whatever the bill is. So we don't control it at all legislatively unless we, I suppose, wrote the law and said that any administrator that wants out this amount, and then they'd let the key area burn down. Please proceed.
Well, again, we're not going to let Tope burn down, and we're sure not going to, you know, if we had a place to pop a lake fire again, we would still fight it. But there are other fires we can identify that we would not go after.
Close to the remote site.
Damn, we're burned already.
It's a remote site, too.
Again, I'm more than happy to work with the committee. Again, the only observation I can make to you is that we spend millions of dollars on the fire suppression, and yet spruce bark beetle kills probably more acreage. And
well put. It probably leads to fires besides.
In terms of at a department level, the FY93 governor's proposed budget included an increment of funding for the state's aggressive program in assuming the wetland permitting issue from the federal government. The decrement I've shown here is a back off on that stand. It preserves some general fund money for that to accomplish what we see as the two major things from our department's view we have to get done. One, we have to get the local soil and water conservation districts more involved in that process. We believe in the ultimate that is probably one of the most effective solutions to the whole wetland permitting issue there is. Secondly, we need to, at a very minimal level, be prepared for a registration system on wetlands, because again, the president's opening to us is this 1% exemption. And for that to be credible, we've got to have some way of assuring people we can track how much of our wetlands have been used. And some sort of registration system is logical. We don't see that as necessarily a big problem. In addition to this money, we, of course, would pursue a number of other projects dependent entirely on the federal funding. And we do have application in, along with DEC, for large amounts of federal money to work the wetlands issue. I don't know what our chances are, but since we represent half of the nation's wetlands, we're not getting anywhere near half the resources to address the wetlands issue. So I think we have a pretty good pitch in that sense. At forest management, which we probably should have put towards the fire suppression, we've got to go in and take a look at our forest management program. I'm aware that people have suggested the closing of field offices. My feeling is that we need to look at the balance of the Anchorage staff and the field offices. In my mind, the priorities in forest management in a reduced budget world are, number one, the personal use type firewood. Number two, the small commercial type wood for the local sawmill, which in many of the remote areas of Alaska provides the building materials for the population. And then third, what I would call the large commercial timber type sales. I'm not sure we've really oriented ourselves that way at this point, and again, that's what I would mean by restructure.
Mr. Chairman?
On the floor.
On the forest management, a couple years ago we had the chief forester here, and we both a bill pushed through on the spruce bark beetle. I know there were a number of positions that were added there. Can you comment briefly on what's happened? Are those people all still in place, or was that just a 1 or 2 year project, or what occurred? And is it necessary to have all those people still stay on board?
Thanks.
At this point, thanks to the funding from the legislature, we have basically worked in a couple areas of Alaska where we are one of the landowners. Because again, the problem with spruce bark beetle is it crosses all the ownership lines. On the Kenai in particular, which is an area of very large concern, we are not even, you know, fourth or fifth hardly on the land ownership list. There are much larger players. We have basically used our efforts there to get together the landowners, identify in what I'm going to call a technically correct sort of way where the damage areas are and those kind of things. So, if you will, we've inventoried the problem technically with all the landowners, and we have a working level.
Is the spruce bark beetle moving down the peninsula in some predictable fashion?
Senator, the only way I can describe it to you is the spruce bark beetle is everywhere on the Kenai Peninsula.
Yeah.
It is endemic. It is always there. And it's just really where the forest comes under stress. It sort of has an outbreak. And once the outbreak starts, then it starts to multiply. The problem's been going on the Kenai for 20 years. But if you look at what's happened in the last 5 years, that's where the real damage has occurred. And it's just broken loose. And at this point, you're starting to see almost the geometric growth of this problem.
So it just keeps moving out from some center of the damaged area.
About one-third of the forest resource on the Kenai has been consumed by the spruce bark beetle.
Mr. Chairman, where is that specifically?
All over.
I mean, all over? Just in patches or, you know, no centralized place or what?
There are a number of areas. I'm sorry, I don't have the map with me, but one of the things we've done as part of this process is to just prepare the map of all the areas. And,
could that map be brought on these days to a subcommittee meeting and inform everybody?
Sure.
Just kind of like to look at it. You have the floor, Senator.
The acreage down the, on the Kenai, I don't exactly know what it is, but isn't it true that in the interior along the Yukon River, I believe in Georgiana Lincoln's district, that it's far worse. It's not even remotely close to the amount of acreage that's been damaged by the spruce bark beetle.
The spruce bark beetle is not a problem generally in southeastern just because the forest grows so much. As you come up through the Kenai, that is probably one of the highest stressed forest areas. And that's why the outbreak there is most visible in terms of percent of the forest resource. When you come up through the Copper River Valley, there is a very large block there of BLM land that has suffered extensive spruce bark beetle damage. As you come to the Yukon River, there are very acreage-wise very large outbreaks, but they are in areas where you're looking at a huge forest resource. I mean, measured in tens of millions of acres, and on a percentage basis, it doesn't show up as bad. But yes, there are some real problems. I guess the thing I'd like to emphasize to you is we're aware of all those, and we worry and think all those areas, whether it be Kenai, the Copper River, or on the Yukon. But the problems are, number one, the Kenai is seen by a large number of people. And frankly, you get the most inquiries as to, why aren't you doing something? Okay. Secondly, the Kenai has proven more difficult to find ways to deal with the problem. Our best solution right now is to undertake a salvage operation. There are parts of the spruce bark beetle damaged timber in the Yukon Kuskokwim that we would love to deal with, but frankly, we don't have any way of even getting to it. Some of it is so remote that we, again, you look at the cost to even just get in there and do anything, and it is a huge cost. Our problem is that the trees, from a forest management point of view, represent a barrier to reforestation, and we need to deal with it if we're going to get reforested in these killed areas. We're hopeful that the salvage operations on the Kenai, that type of an approach, will generate some good ideas.
Mr. Chairman, along those lines, on Kachemak Bay, of course, you know, for years we've had the bill here for the property on Kachemak Bay. Is that infested by the spruce bark beetle, or is that pretty good?
The beetle is endemic. Yeah. You can find the beetle everywhere. There are no real outbreaks in the sense of an unhealthy forest creating the right stress situation down there. That's a good, healthy forest. They get a lot of good rain down there in Homer, and that does help. But again, you put it through a couple, 3 years of drought, and it can certainly break loose in that area, without a doubt.
Actually, your problems in the Kenai and elsewhere may preclude the opportunity for you to reduce your budget fire suppression. Just get some lightning storms and so on. Back up the ladder.
Yeah, generally, our pattern of fires we fight is they're man-made fires along the road system, and every time you're off the road, you're looking at lightning-generated fires, which means the interior. And it is really a very big area, but it is just the interior of Alaska. And we know there literally are hundreds of lightning strikes a day. We do have a way of monitoring and plotting all the lightning strikes every day. And then we go out and look once we start to see a concentration. Because again, if you can get in there early, it really does help.
Thank you.
Okay.
Question?
You have a floor, Senator Schultz. Just
a question. Have you had any success with BLM as far as negotiating salvaging timber from the large tracts of land that they have, or have you worked on that? Or
we specifically have not at this point. We have tried, and we have not. Again, that was not at my level dealing with BLM. And I guess the only ray of hope I can bring you is that because of our work on land selection and a number of other things at the commissioner level, we do have a good relationship with Ed Spang, who heads up the BLM here. And again, we may need to ask them to revisit some of their policies Alaska specific.
What is their major reason for not allowing the salvaging of the
Again, I don't know at this point, Senator. I have not personally intervened in the discussion.
We'll try to let you move along, and the chairman apologized to the committee, too, for resources.
We're doing actions. Quite well here, Senator. Under forest management, the only other thing I want to make sure is footnoted to you is the Keep Green increment that we're eliminating there was a new program. In giving up the $50,000 there, general fund, we would be giving up a federal match. It is a program that is a fire prevention oriented program, but in terms of all the other programmatic stress here, it just doesn't measure up. The same thing is true for the next item, CACFA, which is basically the commission that looks at federal areas. It was set up by the legislature. If you go back and look, you will see the words you wrote in there of temporary. And I guess what we're proposing here is to bring an end to temporary. Certainly, I have no negative feelings about CACFA, but when I measure it against, again, the other programmatic type change, it just doesn't compete in my mind. Additionally, a lot of its purpose related to actions assertions by the state vis-a-vis the federal government. I believe this administration is being aggressive about that already. If nothing else, the money would be better spent in the Attorney General's office to pursue the state's challenge against the federal government.
Please proceed.
In terms of agriculture, we, of course, have been working through our Agriculture Policy Task Force. And while not finalized, it is clear that there is a portion of the Division of Agriculture that is needed to support what I'm going to call the small farm, the family farm type operation. That basic help comes in the form of marketing, inspection, certification, those kind of programs. So what we've looked at here in our reduction is, number one, the state fair's operating support. Again, we certainly support the state fairs and their purpose and what they're about. At a department level, there's just no way for me to compete that kind of support against the other programmatic things that we undertake. Probably more importantly, what I've indicated here is an item on the Agriculture Revolving Loan Fund. What we've basically seen is a drop-off in the ARLF's business. While we do see a need from the smaller farmers for what I'm going to call the operating loan or the crop loan, we do not see a demand for very large loans. The ARLF currently has about $7 million of cash. It is my feeling that there will be some discussion of that during your budget considerations. I think it would be important that we maintain a capitalization to deal with the ARLF's existing assets in terms of both management and in terms of their legal protection. At the same time, we also need to assure that there is some mechanism that will support our agriculture people in terms of their short-term operating loans, and again, whether it be some level of capitalization or sort of some other program, I leave to you. In any case, we have already started to downsize the staffing of the ARLF. This item just says whatever continues in the way of loan support or whatever, it's basically a very small operation people-wise. We do not need the large staff that has been associated with the ARLF in the past.
Question. How does that work in terms of gaining general fund? Most of that money is now, those positions, at least proposed by you, are would be out of the fund, right?
Yes.
Fund source of the ARLF fund. So to affect the savings, you propose lapsing money out of the revolving loan fund in the front section of the budget. Is that how you accomplish the $200,000?
Yes. Again, our proposal here...
You can't
here,
take
again,
it out of the budget. You can't take it out of the DNR's budget.
Yeah, no. Again, in the agriculture area, what I'm trying to indicate to you is I think we can make these kind of contributions towards the budget reduction in agriculture. I am very reluctant to reduce the positions associated with the basic division programs that deal with market inspection, certification, and the PMC. I think those are the two areas where we really are in support of the part of agriculture that we see as alive and well in Alaska based on our visits around the state. On the other hand, both of these areas are, in particular the ARLF, we're trying to acknowledge the reality that a lot of the pressure off the general fund for those type of things can be eliminated. In terms of the mining item, what we've shown here is basically the cost of the state's coal program. This is from a state level, the major coal permitting activity. What we've said here is that we would generate new revenues to support that program. The program is very important in terms of both revenue generation and support of the economy and jobs. On the other hand, a small levy of a few cents per ton on existing coal production will pay for this kind of a program. We could also institute an approach that simply charged a very large permit application for the processing of that one single application. To give you an idea, a major application here might involve a coal mine where you were talking hundreds of millions of dollars of development costs. It might involve, on our part, several man-years of effort that had to be conducted over 6 months to a year. And again, we've taken the approach that we would not be bashful about asking a company to support us financially so that we could properly and promptly process that application. Again, I'm more than open to what balance of those two approaches is used, but we do think it is in support of such a high dollar activity that it certainly can support this level of fee structure somehow. Other than that, we would recommend no other changes in the Division of Mining. It's basically here just trying to pay for ourselves. We do already there, of course, receive a lot of federal dollars for the administration of the federal coal program.
Mr. Chairman?
You have the floor.
Has the administration contemplated any increases in either the
leasing and royalty fees on coal areas on state lands, or increasing of the mineral license or the mining license fee tax?
We have not looked at a revisit of the basic sort of 5% coal royalty approach at this point. We would obviously have that opportunity in finalizing any coal leases with people out into the future. As far as any other tax side of it, I have not entered into that. As you know, I do royalty and bonuses. I don't do taxes, is the way I try to say it to folks.
Of course, one of our charges is we're supposed to look larger and try to relate those things. And I think the current program is, or the current tax for statewide for everything, including all mines and coal mines, is literally in the hundreds of thousands. I think it's $200,000 or $300,000, most of which, even though it's confidential, is probably paid by one operator currently. And there's no way that our basic tax on mining pays for our state involvement in mining, let alone all the other impacts of it.
Again, we have not undertaken the analysis from that point of view. I am aware of some studies that have looked at it in sort of a tax-based issue. And again, what we see is mining's impact is largest through job creation, the economic impact on communities.
Which creates schools and creates the negative side of that, which no one wants to pay for in the coal mining business, let me tell you.
Again, I have strong impressions of Kotzebue 15, 20 years ago, and again, I have strong impressions of Kotzebue today. And
through government funding.
You know, I wish I had a few more red dogs to put into areas like that.
Go ahead. Well, Commissioner, not to speak for Al Adams' area, he knows better than anybody, but I don't know. My guess is we have not yet quite seen all the effects of Red Dog. I think that's something developed in the future. What you've seen in the last 10 or 15 years has been a lot of, you know, government-related activities going on in Kotzebue.
Well, again, Senator, I was out there this summer, and I saw a lot of local people employed at that mine. And, again, within this administration, one of our focuses has been is how to generate new real jobs in rural Alaska. And I can't think of anything that's done a better job of that.
It's pretty much legislative generated. We put a couple hundred million in it, made loans and contributions. It wasn't exactly an administrative proposal. In fact, I think you drug them kicking and screaming for a while, previous administrations, so they got going. It took a lot of legislative effort, and some of the people at this table led the way, not only from the Senator's district, which he was a very strong part of, but Senator Porcheau and others. Don't argue with you, except that there's a time, as the former Governor Hammond said, that there ought to be a preparation after you get people in. At some stage, the royalties ought to equal the expenditure that you can call upon that's predictable. And I see DNR more than once telling us how much they're making out of lands, for instance, and create $1 billion worth of liability downstream from the tax base. They don't make a dime from lands. And the same thing in these royalties. I know as a good mining engineer, your philosophy is probably, economics may say just exactly what you said up front, but you're also a very intelligent man, and you know that somebody's paying, and I'm classic vested interest, somebody's paying the schools and the other impacts in the various areas that some stage the royalty should pick up.
Senator, again, I'm not differing with you. I guess I'm just trying to observe that when I compare mining to, say, oil and gas, one of the differences, mining's impacts come through job creation, and just to finish the point with you, more municipal taxation level type impacts. In other words, they provide tax base in the local area. And again, all I'm saying is that if you want to do an analysis of the industry, I think you got to look at what different levels get what out of mining. And it is just more locally oriented than, quote, statewide oriented. And that's the point I'm making.
You have the floor, Senator.
I I don't quibble with the, that there are some benefits to this, but I think what we're going to want to be interesting to go back and see, for example, where, let's take the new Denali Borough that's supposedly being funded or formed. I assume that that includes Senator Schultz, the Healy coal mine. So you've got a new borough starting, whether, you know, it's going to be interesting to see, look at their, just their school situation, see if that borough is through the taxation or property taxation mechanism there, whether that school cost in moving from maybe an REAA to a borough situation on schools, what the overall net impacts of state funding for that are. I know we can also look at the Northwest Arctic School District probably now and go back and do some of that look when you move from an REAA, say, to a, just on the schools alone. I'm not sure that there are, I mean, if that those kind of comparisons are going to be very interesting. I mean, we do have a minimum millage rate that has to be met by local school districts other than REAAs, and the figures so far, and Senator Adams can speak more to it, but I mean, they're barely making the mandatory contribution rate. Whether or not those kinds of developments through taxation ever get beyond and be, you know, big contributors or extra contributors to local economies, I think the analysis still has to be done on that. Now, that does not count the personal spending that clearly results from local employment, and that, you know, has business and economic spinoffs. But, you know, we're primarily looking here in this exercise and the whole exercise of state government as to whether or not some of these state government costs are offset through development. We don't have good capture programs here in Alaska for trying to capture economic spinoffs to help run government, particularly state government. And, you know, on a local level, there are property tax and sales tax mechanisms, but even those, I think, become limited. And clearly you have business interests that are not interested in creating more operating costs that can be competitively disadvantaged to them on a world market, and I mean, you know, you get into lots of those kinds of considerations.
And of course, it's incumbent upon the administration to propose reductions and proposes the statutory language be drafted to achieve those reductions, as Senator Adams so wisely brought up at the beginning of the session. I would think that statutory language to achieve income also to support budget is always in order too.
Senator, while we're sort of on the point, I think it raises the more general issue of what's not on the sheet. You do not see on the sheet, for instance, reductions in oil and gas. I believe we've tightened that program as much as we can. As a matter of fact, in the FY93 governor's budget, there are increments proposed that we have left in. That is just too important a revenue generator for us, and we just can't find anything to cut around the edges there that doesn't start to have an impact on the benefit of people. All I'm trying to suggest to you is that I think the Division of Mining, you know, with a little over $1 million total cost out of a $50 million department budget, is at a level where I don't know how to cut it without starting to hurt the revenue generation capability of this resource state. That's all I'm trying to say to you. In this case, I'm more than happy, and I'm not proud. I'll go out and ask for money from the people that we're performing this major regulatory function for. I'm not proud about that at all. But I really, in a management sense, don't want to reduce that program anymore. It's such a small division right now that I just... I'm at a point with several of these divisions where I just don't have any give left in the number of people. And that's why you see a very heavy orientation in here to going out and getting money to pay for.
Please proceed, and thank you.
Okay. In the parks area, we, of course, already have pending some increases in our existing park fees. What we've proposed in this item here in FY93 of $150,000 is the introduction of day use fees on a number of our highly developed facilities around Alaska that are utilized basically on a day-use basis. We have a few facilities that we over the years, you over the years, have put millions of dollars into, and they are very high day use. We do not currently charge any day use fees. Now, if you look at a McHugh Creek, South of Anchorage, for instance, a very attractive facility in terms of parking lot, bathrooms, trails, just, you know, frankly, the maintenance cost is incredible on that thing on a day use basis. And again, if we're going to maintain a level of service, we think we need to get into that area. Now, I don't want you to think that this is a large hunk of money. I mean, we're talking a buck or two a car type of thing. We're not talking about putting rangers out there with guns to collect it. The Park Service enjoys very good volunteer support. Over half the people hours working within our state parks are volunteer hours. We pay for less than 90 hours of Park Service work here at Alaska. So we're currently raising about one-third of our cost through fee structures, permits, all those type of things. We've set a longer-term objective of raising about a half. This is a step towards it. It's tapping into another group. In the interior, this would impact Fort Slade probably. Where again, we've put a few million bucks in there, and there is a lot of day use.
Please.
Please proceed. Thank you.
In terms of the commissioner's office, Sharon, you might explain the DOA charge that item there.
Included in the governor's FY93 budget is an increment for chargeback costs that arose out of the adjustment after DOA transferred in the base chargeback allocations back to the departments in combination with 5% growth in use of computers in the department. We are heavy users of mainframe computing in the department. We based that increment on the best information we had available last summer and fall as we were putting the budget together. We have much better information today, both about how the new rates structure will affect the department and about the actual amount being allocated back to the department, and just as important, about what SysM is going to cost us to use compared with...
Did you cut any bodies in the commissioner's office?
Did we? Pardon?
Did you reduce any personal services of Commissioner's office?
Senator, as part of both this item and then sort of jumping down to the bottom, there's two relevant items. Commissioner's office reductions restored and then other reductions, appropriation restructuring. Those items towards the bottom, those two items sort of summing there, represent what we've identified sort of as the miscellaneous reductions.
Okay.
Those are the kind of management things that, again, you just, there are some work we undertake where we have the option to sort of stop at 90% done and not spend that last 20%, 30%, 40% to do that last 10%. That certainly represents economies we would hope to achieve, but have not identified the restructuring of our support and administrative functions right now. That was a move we only made last week, and we just simply haven't identified where those items are. I don't have any other great moves in mind. At this point, I guess I've gained one position out of the move I've made, but you know, I don't know how we need to be organized, and Sharon frankly needs some time to work on that. I mean, we just haven't had it at this point.
I'd like to go on to the land section because of time.
The land item represents some fairly major direction in terms of both policy change and legislative change. Let me sort of group together aquatic farming and shore fisheries. Both of these areas deal with the state as the owner of the submerged lands. Under current direction, we act at a very detailed level. We are dealing with decisions and leases measured in a few hundreds of feet. We in areas, I mean, it looks like zoning to me. And it's even small lot zoning is the way it looks to me. I believe we better serve the interests of the public as a state by going through a good public process to identify areas for these use, and then helping to create either the cooperative type structures or something like that that actually deal with the registration and the adjudication of disputes. The model I would give you is the old mining districts. Somehow miners used to be able to come into an area, self-organize, they provided for the registration claims and the adjudication.